first one we bring to the microphones today. We bring Colonel Bob McGinnis to meet with us around this broadcast table and talk about events that are happening. And Bob, there's a headline, I'm looking at it right now here on my computer. Hamadanijad says, "Whosoever controls the Middle East controls the world's wealth." Man, that has great significance as you look at Bible prophecy. But indeed, is that the case? I mean, the oil that's coming out of that part of the world, are they controlling really what's happening geopolitically across the world?
Certainly, oil dictates a great deal of the flow of commerce around the world, and we are tethered to oil. However, there are alternative findings. You certainly have in the Gulf of Guinea off of Nigeria and Ghana major new findings that will increase our import to about 20% from West Africa. And then Uganda has in the Lake region and Eastern Africa major finds as well. So there are alternatives. And, of course, even President Obama the other night on State of the Union made it clear that they're going to begin to look at more nuclear reactors and allowing exploration off our coast. We have plenty of oil off our own coast and in Alaska that can make up a significant difference. But I don't disagree that given the current structures in OPEC that oil has a great deal to do with the wealth of the world, but that oil could become worthless if, in fact, we find alternative energy sources, which we're trying to explore all the time.
And, you know, even that statement right there has a significance in Bible prophecy. Bible prophecy focuses on those Middle Eastern nations that are the major producers of petroleum products today. And, in fact, if we move away from that, they won't have that power and or the economic capabilities of doing some of the things. Very interesting comment. Well, you mentioned President Obama in his State of the Union speech the other night. I wanted to get your play on that. What are your thoughts? The one thing I noticed, he didn't talk much about security, and that is concerning to me. What do you think?
I agree. His only constitutional obligation as president is to secure this country. He spoke of about 8 different topics in the State of the Union, which is the longest on record, more than 70 minutes. In 9 of those minutes, he very quickly brushed on these national security topics. I was very concerned that he was rather flippant when it came to Afghanistan and Iraq. He tried to outline his philosophical desires to reduce atomic threats, and I think that that was complimentary. But, you know, he gave us no substance in North Korea or Iran, and then, of course, he talked about homosexuals in the military, which, of course, is something that a very small minority of his far-left party is very interested in, but the rest of the country, unfortunately, is going to have to suffer because of that.
Talk to me about that. The military were very stone-faced as the cameras picked them up after he talked about changing the don't ask, don't tell philosophy in the military. I imagine that since he's the commander-in-chief, they're going to stand in chain of command and do what is they're told to do. But is that going to bring harm to our military?
Jimmy, first of all, in 93, when I worked on this issue, there was a law that was written, 10 U.S.C. 654, which is a statute that Congress passed under its constitutional obligation of Article 1, Section 8, that says that the military will not allow homosexuals to serve. Now, of course, we have the Clinton administration's wink and nod, which is the implementation regulations of that law, which allows homosexuals to serve in the closet, but not openly. Now, the president cannot, by executive order or by any other order, vacate a law. My concern is that on Tuesday, we've got Secretary Gates and Admiral Mullen, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, are going to stand before a Senate committee, and they're going to explain what they're going to do. Well, I could care less necessarily what they say, because they would have to repeal a law, they, the Congress, before the military can ignore the law of the land. They're on tenuous grounds. The president decides that he doesn't want the military to enforce a law of the Congress, then we have a constitutional crisis. The Supreme Court has refused to hear this particular law because six appellate courts have already upheld it as credible, as legal. So I just think that the president, once again, has overreached. He is creating a crisis that is unnecessary, especially a crisis with our country at war, with young men and women dying in various locations. We don't need this. We demonstrated that to the Congress in 93. I'm just incredibly disappointed, but I suspect you'll hear much more of it about this next week.
You said he was rather flippant as he referred to Afghanistan. Prime Minister Brown of Great Britain talking about a deadline for Afghanistan. I think, if I remember correctly, our earlier conversations, you said that's what concerned you. Let's go in. Let's increase the troops on the ground there. But don't set a deadline. Are you still of that same persuasion?
Well, if the intent is to win a counterinsurgency, you don't establish deadlines. You know, we did a study over the last 40, 50 years, in which we looked at all counterinsurgencies. The average successful counterinsurgency was somewhere close to 14 years. Now, I agree that we've been there since 2001, but we haven't been treating it as a counterinsurgency. Now, if the Brits, who have 4,000 or so people on the ground, decide because of domestic polls that it's time to pull out, which I think is really the reason behind what Brown is saying, then, you know, others hopefully will not follow. We have a tepid commitment by our 26 NATO allies who have ponied up a lot of forces, but most of them don't fight. It's 100,000 or so Americans who will eventually be there after this so-called surge that will have to carry the brunt of the battle. And yet we're finding all sorts of problems with the Pakistanis unwilling to do their role. And, of course, there's talk of trying to buy off the Taliban. I suspect in the next few months we'll find some sort of compromise that will allow the president to smile, say, yeah, we're going to begin to pull out the troops in 2011. But I don't believe that Afghanistan or Central Asia will be any better as a result of all the blood and all the treasure we spent there.
That is true. Ayatollah Ali Khomeini, who is the supreme ruler in Iran, has now echoed the president, Ahmadinejad's statement that Israel is going to be destroyed. First time he's publicly come out, and in fact, it's a bit more than even what his official website had to say about it. He's saying Israel's going to be destroyed. You have Iran and its leadership denying the Holocaust ever took place, and this, of course, during the week when internationally, people stopped to remember the Holocaust and the dastardly event that took place 65 years ago. I don't know if you have an answer for this, Bob. I just wanted to see what your thoughts were. Why in the world is Iran so set on destroying the Jewish state, denying everything that is history, documented history? Why are they doing this?
It's pragmatic domestic politics, Jimmy. Ali Khomeini and Ahmadinejad, his puppet, are in political trouble in their own country. They have riots, demonstrations since the June 12th election of this past year. Their, I suppose, grasp on power is in trouble. They have always had to defer to an issue that can, you know, demonstrate their own prowess, their own reason for existing. And so they tout their totalitarian ways against Israel, saying they're going to destroy them or that Israel's going to be destroyed because that plays well on the Iranian street, plays well throughout the Gulf region and in the Arab world. I just don't put a lot of credibility in this type of rhetoric because I don't think that it certainly upsets people in Jerusalem, but it's intended just as a deflection from the dire circumstance that Iran faces against the West with regard to its atomic programs, and, of course, the consequence of, you know, internal dissent, which is very real and I think could possibly topple that regime.
Hey, Bob, I only have 30 seconds. Tony Blair has been questioned about his role in the Iraqi war. Why are we still talking about that? He's not in leadership anymore. Why this continuing question of the part that they played?
what I consider the far left in Great Britain is like the left in this country. They don't forgive. They don't understand. They never accepted the rationale for the war. Now, it's clearly the intelligence communities, and I was involved in listening to what they were saying during the formulation up to the war. We're saying something entirely different from what we found on the ground. And Blair, as well as Bush and other senior leaders, fell victim to the best intelligence we had. Intelligence is more of an art than a science, unfortunately, because when you don't have insiders in places like Tehran or Baghdad, inside of totalitarian regimes, you often don't know what the reality is. And quite frankly, Saddam kept close hold to all the information that we seem to think in our intelligence community was quite the contrary.
Colonel Bob McGinnis, he's our man that looks at geopolitical activities across the world. Thank you, Bob. Talk to you again next week.
Thank you, Jimmy.